I wanted to ask about GMOs and how that...
Oh, GMOs. GMOs was a solution looking for a problem. They essentially found something they could do in the lab, and they turned around and said, all right, now we need to find a way to actually market this. Part of the problem in the world, especially in the industrial countries, is nothing will ever be done and no solution will ever be attempted unless it makes someone a whole ton of money. A simple solution that doesn't cost anything is never an option because it won't make money. So, for example, in Mexico, where my wife is from and where I do research in the Sierra Tarahumara, people used to live, and they still do live, in adobe houses. But that's falling out of favor, partially because you can't get a loan to build yourself an adobe house. Well, why can't you get a loan to build yourself an adobe house? Because the concrete companies, the block companies, the brick companies are the same group as the finance companies, and they're not going to make money if somebody goes out in the backyard, digs a hole and makes his own adobe and makes his own yard. It would be much better for the individual, but the economy as a whole, the hyper-growth economy, wouldn't flourish. And so as a result, you have policies which actually hurt the small person trying to make their own house. Or, as another example of a GMO looking for a solution, looking for a problem, several years ago, they discovered golden rice, which was a genetically modified rice that had, I think, greater levels of vitamin A. And they said that this vitamin A could cure many kinds of blindness in developing countries. The problem with that is you had to eat a whole bunch of this rice to get the benefit of the vitamin A, even though it was part of the marking solution. The other problem was if you had a balanced diet, you wouldn't be blind either. So the easy, simple solution is just to get these people a balanced diet rather than force feed them this vitamin A. The same year, in the back pages of the newspaper, was reported an amazing discovery that would double the production of rice on paddies all over the world. And the simple, cheap solution you wouldn't have to pay anybody any money for is to grow two kinds of rice together. Because the disease likes one kind of rice, and just by growing two kinds together means that it spreads a whole lot slower, hence you get more rice production. But doesn't make anyone money except for the small rice producer. So that's sort of genetically modified foods in a nutshell. Whether or not they actually are healthy for you, all those questions I see is moot, because if you look at what the purpose of genetically modified organs are, those purposes can be solved much easier in many other ways. Just a diversity of a diet, other food crops, good old fashioned hybridization, which actually was a bad thing occasionally in the past during the Green Revolution. But that's another question or another story.
And what are the, like, these chemical companies that are producing all these GMOs, what's the relationship with the farmers, and how does that...
Well, it's interesting you call them chemical companies, because that's what they are, but now they're marketing themselves as life science corporations, life science country, breadbasket to the world. You know, it's amazingly Weber, it's a Weberian world, but it's an Orwellian world we live, where chemical companies are now life science companies. I did a quick search on the web before I came out here, and there's the National Family Farmers Coalition, and on their webpage they have the perfect tack in terms of what these chemical companies really want to do. They want to get people into buying their seeds, and they want to sell them to them, and they'll do it any way they can. And if you don't buy their seeds, then you'll be targeted. There is a farmer, Percy Schmeiser, in Canada, who had one in his wheat fields, I believe, a GMO strain blown in, which contaminated his field because he actually saved seeds. Saving seeds, by the way, is another way that you can counteract the whole corporate spread of large farms, is you can save your own seeds and grow them yourselves, heirloom crops. Many native cultures around the world are doing this. Vandana Shiva has an association in India. Gary Nabhan in northern Arizona is also doing the same thing. But poor Percy had this stuff blow into his field, and Monsanto sued him for theft. And Monsanto won because the courts claimed that Percy was now growing something that he did not legitimately have access to do, which then gets in the whole concept of actually patenting the genome, giving someone private property. The whole intellectual property rights phenomenon is a way for chemical companies in the core countries, in the industrialized countries, to sort of usurp the universal access that farmers and the rest of the world have had to grow their own food. And this is also part of the techniques. I talked earlier about how exporting surplus from the United States to developing countries is one way that we force this migration. Another way to force the migration is patenting crops in developing countries and not letting them grow them without royalties. So the neem tree in India was one of these things, and Vandana Shiv also speaks about this. Let's see, what else? Throw questions at me so I can riff on them.
Okay. So how has it actually affected the economy of...
Well, when the question comes down to how has it affected the economy, that's a $20,000 question, because you have to say, well, which economy is affected? How do you measure the economy? Herman Daly talks a lot in his books. Herman Daly was an economist at the World Bank that kind of blew the whistle on the World Bank. He has several books out and talks a lot about local economies and beyond growth, trying to get beyond the economic idea of consistent growth, that we actually live in a world of finite sinks and finite resources. But what was the question?
How has it affected the... How have the GMOs...
Oh, affected the economies.
And it could be local economies. It could be... Or even the relationship... Like a friend of mine who's a farmer in Nebraska was saying, you know what? I don't agree with the GMOs, but we... It's like the Walmart of farming. Like, we go... They're cheap. It's low risk. I mean, we can... Everyone's growing them, and it's what you can afford because farming is not easy.
Well, if you're the kind of farmer who farms for a large market, then you're between a rock and a hard place. It's kind of where you have to go. If you don't want the cheap and easy short-term solution out, you're going to have to opt out of selling to large corporations and try to look around for a local market. Very difficult in Nebraska. There is no local market in Nebraska. The whole rural community has disappeared over the years. In the Midwest, in the Western Midwest, it's a tricky question, actually, on whether there actually should have been farmers there in the first place. Wallace Stegner writes about John Wesley Powell, who was the first white fellow who floated the Grand Canyon. In his book, Beyond the 100th Meridian, talks about how those places shouldn't be farmed in the first place. It's actually a grazing land, buffalo grazing land. So there are lots of dynamics at work in terms of whether or not those farms, small family farms in places like Nebraska, Sand Hills of Nebraska is a place like this. But in terms of how it actually affects local economies or larger economies, it can look like it has a positive effect on the larger economy. But on the local economy, it could be absolutely devastating. For example, when it looks like it's good for the larger economy, bad for the local economy. Vandana Shiver, in her book Biopiracy, talks about when the Green Revolution came along and they gave them hybridized forms of wheat, which had very large heads of wheat and very short stalks, which seems, from a very sort of mechanical perspective, much more efficient. Less energy in stalk, more energy in the actual head of the wheat. The problem was, local farmers used all that stalk to feed their cattle. So although they were producing more wheat, now they had to buy food to feed their cattle. And Shiva calls those that effect shadow acres, acres that are lost, because you start prioritizing one input and one output in a very mechanistic sort of linear equation, instead of looking to maximize the entire equation. And these local cultures often indigenous, especially in places like India, have evolved over generations, maximizing what works in a local situation and what helps their survival. An interesting and American example that Wendell Berry talks about a lot are the Amish. The Amish produce for themselves first, and then they have some things that they sell on the markets. And as a result, they're highly autonomous. And this is the political aspect of the equation, that if you produce food for yourselves, you have more autonomy, you're less vulnerable and dependent on anyone else. So the Amish can really do what they want because they don't depend on anyone else. And the state, meaning the government of the entire country, really likes you to be dependent on them. So there's this tension then between small local producers, which is sort of the basis of democracy, and the state itself, which wants to maximize all those transactions that it can tax. This is why the state hates peasants everywhere. Peasants produce for themselves. You can't tax that. It's very difficult to. And when you do tax it, then you make very angry peasants. So any type of local consumption, the state says, is bad because it doesn't end up in the national economy. So questions of how it actually affects the economy get very complicated very quickly, because you have to talk about, well, which economy are we really speaking of? And we could talk, and we could even refer to Wendell Berry's concept of the great economy, which is not just the ones that the economists think about, but the spiritual end of the economy and the environmental sort of beginning of the economy. Or you could reverse that, the spiritual beginning of the economy and the environmental end of the economy.
I have questions going through my head constantly, and then when you stop talking, I
that's why they give you...
I know, that's the pen, the hands, what do I do?